Chief Justice Steele, members of the court, my name is Joseph Bernstein. I'm here representing Michael Smith. I think I want to start out by just reminding the court that it's been 40 years since the court decided Bland versus State. And in Bland, the court recognized that where you have a case where the outcome could very well turn on the question of the credibility of a co-conspirator or an accomplice, that a special instruction is warranted concerning giving the jury an instruction that tells them to pay particular note about issues concerning the credibility of accomplice testimony. Now, since Bland, I would agree that this court has issued several decisions, Cabrera, Holloman, or Solomon, and Bordley, where the court has approved something less than what I'll call a pure Bland instruction. And the court has approved those, I'm going to call them, watered down Bland instructions, on the theory that the trial court has broad discretion to fashion jury instructions. And as long as the trial court lives up to, I guess, the spirit of Bland, we're going to give the trial courts a great deal of leeway in how they formulate that instruction. Well, in this case, there was no Bland instruction. There was no watered-down Bland instruction. There was no special instruction of any kind given concerning the testimony of Mr. DeShields, who was an admitted accomplice and who, in fact, was the trigger man in this robbery homicide. And I would also like the court, or to remind the court, that when this court decided Mr. Smith's direct appeal, the court took note that almost the entirety of the case turned on the credibility of DeShields versus the credibility of Michael Smith, who testified in his own defense in this case and essentially denied that he was a participant, an accomplice, and he denied that he had anything to do with these crimes. So we have a situation here where no Bland instruction was given, no watered-down Bland instruction, none was asked for, and the only instruction concerning credibility was the general credibility instruction that is given in every criminal case.
Now, as you know, there's some suggestion that that decision was a trial strategy. Let's just assume hypothetically it was clear on this record it was a strategy. Is that a legitimate strategy, or are you arguing for the position that no effective trial counsel would ever not request the Bland instruction?
Well, if you look at the cases, and I think there are several cases cited beginning in page 20 of our opening brief, and if you think about it, there is no downside to asking for a Bland instruction, and the decisions we cited in our brief basically say that. They say there, no, it can't be a strategy.
Well, I understand. My question wasn't intended to be rhetorical, because if you don't have an objection, and we review it in a direct appeal for plain error, unless we conclude it was strategic, and then we're not going to review it for plain error, then we get to the post-conviction setting when we're talking about the effective assistance of counsel and whether it was a legitimate strategic choice. So it would be helpful for us to know the precedent you're advocating, and are you taking the position that it is never effective or possibly strategic not to request the Bland instruction?
Well, I'm not going to say never, but I will say that on the record in this case, there is nothing in the record to suggest that the attorneys made a strategic decision. the attorneys basically filed, I think it was a letter affidavit with the court, saying, we agree this is a valid claim. The only, I guess, strategic thing about the Shields that is in the record is that defense counsel agreed that they shouldn't tell the jury that the Shields had been convicted. Now, you can ask yourself the question, well, once the jury hears the Shields' testimony and once the jury hears that the Shields is a shooter, what's the jury going to think? I mean, are they going to think he got immunity? So even that decision is almost...
Well, it's possible to craft a bland construction and take care of that within
it. Of course it,
it
is.
Well, why, as you point out, it's been on the books for 40 years. There's no record made about a trial strategy that would reasonably call one to conclude no bland instruction was desirable or necessary in this case. We understand many cases say that every party is entitled to a correct instruction on the law from the trial judge. Where was the trial judge here? Why didn't the trial judge intervene and ask counsel, don't I have to give a bland instruction in this case?
I don't know. The only thing I can conclude was that everybody was asleep at the switch on this issue.
Well, you would think, given the fact that bland's been around for 40 years, when you have an accomplice testifying and the superior court's kind of arranging its instructions on reasonable doubt or whatever, the superior court would say at the prayer conference, and I'm going to give a bland instruction, and then we would have a record of the prayer conference where someone says, well, I object. Or
there is a record of the prayer conference, and the subject simply never came up. It was never raised by defense counsel. It was never raised by the trial judge. And, of course, the state's not going to bring it up because they have no interest in having that instruction given.
Well, one would hope they'd have an interest in not having a potential conviction reversed on appeal, so they would at least bring up the subject and put defense counsel on the spot to rationalize why defense counsel doesn't want the instruction.
Well, I think if that had happened, then there might be some argument to be made that whatever defense counsel said was strategy. I want it or I don't want it.
I understand the record in this case. What's just surprising to the court is with Bland being around for 40 years and so many cases deciding Bland, it's hard to imagine a prayer conference taking place in a trial with accomplice liability testimony where nobody's talking about Bland.
Well, I didn't try this case. And when I went through the record of the transcript of the trial, which was extensive, and read through everything and took a couple weeks to mull it over, and look, I guess in my mind a little light went off my head. I said, wait a minute, there's something missing here. And what was missing was the bland. Not only was there no bland instruction given, there wasn't even any discussion about it. It just never showed up on the court's radar or defense counsel's radar. It just, and quite frankly, to me, it was inexplicable.
Well, there appear to be rules around the country, in federal courts, that if you ask for a bland instruction and it's not given, that can be reversible error. And then there's some that say you don't have to give an instruction, some state courts, unless it's requested. And the Third Circuit says it's better to practice to give the instruction if it's requested.
Correct.
Doesn't all of that imply that counsel has the option not to ask for a bland instruction?
Well, I think the Strickland cases say that if a bland instruction is appropriate in a given case and defense counsel doesn't ask for it, that's deficient performance under Strickland.
What would be the leading case for that proposition?
Those cases are all cited beginning on page 20 of appellant's opening brief. I don't recall them off the top of my head, but there are a half a dozen court of appeals cases from around the country. And I think it's also important to note that the if you look at the trial court decision here, the trial court tried to rationalize not giving a Bland instruction by basically saying, well, I gave all the ingredients of a Bland instruction, and you can find them all in the general credibility instruction. Now, the trial court did not cite any authority for the proposition that giving a general credibility instruction will cure a Bland-type error. And the state hasn't cited any authority for that proposition. And I don't know if there is any authority for that proposition. I could not find any. And the cases, especially in the federal court, dealing with Strickland claims based on a failure to ask for a credibility of accomplice testimony instruction, have consistently held, number one, there is no strategy in not asking for it. And number two, if you don't ask for it, it's deficient performance. And the only question that is usually left open in these cases is whether it was prejudicial. That is there a reasonable probability, viewing all the evidence, that this error contributed to the verdict? And in this case, I think the answer to the prejudice question is not a close question. This court already decided.
Would you comment?
Credibility was the icing on the cake. It was
Mr. Bernstein.
Yes.
Would you comment on United States versus Isaac? This is a Third Circuit case in 1998, where apparently the Third Circuit held that refusal to give a cautionary accomplice testimony jury instruction was not an abuse of discretion, quote, although it would have been better had the district court given the instruction, unquote, and, quote, may well be the better practice to give such an instruction if requested, unquote, because the defendant's counsel was, quote, permitted to conduct a vigorous defense, unquote, and, quote, the trial court instructed the jury that they were the judges of credibility and should consider the witnesses' motives, the circumstances under which they had testified, and the relationship each might have to the prosecution or defense, unquote. Is that case relevant?
I'm not familiar with the name of the case. Was that a Strickland case, or was it a direct appeal?
I believe it was a direct appeal, United States versus Isaac, 134 F. 3rd, okay. 199 at 204. Oh.
I think whether or not a Bland-type instruction is given in a given case, the issue on direct appeal is a little bit different than a Strickland claim, where the claim is my lawyer rendered deficient assistance because he didn't ask for a Bland instruction. Now, I am sure there are a number of cases out there, like the one you cited, where a court on direct appeal will say it was an error for the court to refuse a Bland instruction or not to give one or to give a watered-down Bland instruction. But I think the cases where the issue was did I get ineffective assistance of counsel because my lawyer didn't ask for one are consistent in saying that failure to request a Bland instruction is a Strickland violation, and if there's prejudice, the defendant's entitled to a new trial.
Well, it's that second ingredient that intrigues me. If you try to relate the it may be okay on direct appeal under certain circumstances to the prejudice prong of Strickland, could there really be, at least under Delaware's current law, any circumstance on direct appeal where defense counsel asked for a Bland instruction and a trial judge denied it, other than through a process of concluding that failure to give it would not prejudice the defendant?
Well, I think under if you're talking about Delaware law, a defendant's entitled to a Bland instruction, the way I read the case law, and that if a trial judge faced with a request for a Bland instruction didn't give a pure Bland instruction or didn't give a watered-down Bland instruction, that would be reversible error unless the error was harmless. So I think in Delaware, where you have Bland out there, defendant's entitled to, as you say, a correct statement of the law.
Well, if we were to look carefully at the Isaacs case that Justice Ridgely has pointed out, in the analysis that the Third Circuit applied, though it was a direct appeal, wouldn't they be concluding that having considered the trial judge's decision not to give the instruction, it's implicit that not giving the instruction would not prejudice the defendant?
Well, I think the first question you have to ask, I'm not sure what jurisdiction, I assume that was a federal prosecution?
Yes, United States okay. versus Isaacs.
And standing here right now, I'm not that well versed in the status of giving that type of instruction in the federal courts to say whether a defendant in a federal prosecution would be entitled to a Bland instruction as they would be in Delaware. So well, I'm kind of missing that.
My question may have misdirected your argument. You were going to address the issue of prejudice and why there was prejudice in this case.
Okay. I can do that. There was prejudice in this case because it was the testimony of DeShields that was, for the most part, uncorroborated, especially as to the homicide and Smith's role in that homicide that got Smith convicted. There really wasn't anything to corroborate DeShields' testimony, for the most part, in nearly all of the offenses that were charged. If you believed DeShields, you believe that Michael Smith was an accomplice and a participant. If you believed Michael Smith was not an accomplice, was not a participant, and was not guilty of anything. And the prejudice arises from the fact that the jury was not given the benefit of a Bland instruction to basically direct the jury to be a little bit suspicious and cautious about the credibility of Mr. DeShields. And every case that is cited in our brief, beginning on page 20, reaches the conclusion that when you look and to determine prejudice under Strickland, the court has to ask itself, was the error trivial or was it pervasive? Pervasive basically means did the Bland error go to the heart of the case? And in this case, I believe it did. And I can only point the court to what the court said in Smith's direct appeal. This case turned almost entirely on the credibility of DeShields versus the credibility of Smith. And I would suggest that an instruction, like a Bland instruction, that would have directly impacted the jury's assessment of the credibility of DeShields makes it prejudicial. That combination, not giving the instruction and the centrality of DeShields' testimony.
And what did the Superior Court judge say on that in response to that point?
Well, the Superior Court judge rationalized that I gave a general credibility instruction, and that was good enough.
So what was absent from the instruction that you want given?
Well, then you get to the question of if the trial judge had given a Bland instruction, would the trial judge have given a pure Bland instruction or one of the watered-down versions. It depends what it, you know, when you compare the general credibility instruction to a pure Bland instruction, it's very clearly deficient. It becomes a little closer if you compare a general credibility instruction to the instruction that was given in Cabrera. It's a little bit closer, but there, even the state's brief concedes that there are missing elements. They're not exactly the same. And there, in fact, there is no case that says a general credibility instruction cures Bland error. If that were so, Bland wouldn't exist. Even Cabrera wouldn't exist.
What do you make of this comment from the trial judge's February 18, 2009 opinion? He says that the court gave the rest of the accomplice charge. What does he mean? What does the trial judge mean?
I think
by that?
He was referring to the general credibility instruction. There, if you read the jury instructions, the only instruction on credibility was the general credibility instruction that's given in every case. There was no separate Bland instruction, Cabrera instruction.
Well, was the trial judge under the assumption that he had given an accomplice charge?
I don't know. But it's absolutely 100% clear from the record that general credibility instruction was the only instruction.
Was he talking about an accomplice liability instruction?
Well, there was an accomplice liability. There was the standard accomplice liability instruction, but that doesn't have anything to do with witness credibility.
I understand the difference. I'm just wondering if that reference by the trial judge to accomplice instruction was a reference to the accomplice liability instruction he gave.
Well, quite frankly, when I read that, I was mystified. I don't know. But the only thing I do know is that a Bland instruction wasn't given. Well, I'm going to save the rest of my 2.5 minutes for some brief rebuttal. I appreciate the court's attention. Thank you.
May it please the court, Abby Adams on behalf of the state of Delaware. Your Honors, the Superior Court did not abuse its discretion in denying Mr. Smith's motion. There are two main issues with Mr. Smith's argument. He cannot show that counsel erred, and he cannot show prejudice. He cannot show that counsel erred because at the time of this trial, Bland was not the applicable law. Boardley was, and he received the substance of the Boardley instruction. Furthermore, as the court questioned earlier, counsel's one-line response, "We believe this is a valid claim by defendant," does not really address the counsel's trial strategy. Here, it's very clear that the trial strategy was that Michael Smith was an innocent bystander. He didn't bring any guns. He didn't fire any guns. He didn't shoot at anyone. He didn't plan to rob anyone. Given that trial strategy and that was in counsel's head throughout the trial, it's objectively reasonable that they did not request a Bland instruction, particularly a Bland instruction, because Bland talks about uncorroborated testimony. And here the testimony was corroborated by DeShield, which is a point that Mr. Smith avoids. Third,
is the record, does it contain evidence that counsel actually made that strategy choice?
No, it doesn't. All that we have, Your Honor, is the one-line statement that we think that Mr. Smith has a valid claim here, and there's nothing else in the record that leans to that strategy other than reviewing the entire record and looking at the fact that they were definitely focused on the fact that Michael Smith was an innocent bystander.
What do you make of the trial judge's reference again in his most recent opinion that the parties agreed to not inform the jury of DeShield's conviction? Is there any significance to that?
Well, I think it goes to the idea that I can't say that it's necessarily related to this strategy decision, but I couldn't say that it's unrelated either. I mean, obviously, they didn't want to connect DeShields to Smith, and they didn't want the jury in their minds to connect whatever DeShields had been convicted of to Mr. Smith. So perhaps that was all part of one strategy decision to distance the two and to not focus on what had happened to Mr. DeShields, bringing that into Smith's trial.
Well, should we assume from the trial judge's comment that that's what the trial judge believed had taken place as a part of a rationale for not giving a Bland charge?
I think there's adequate inference in the record that that's what happened, yes. Further, Your Honors, Mr. Smith can't show prejudice here for three reasons. First of all, the instruction that was given was a correct statement of the law, and this court has not reversed where the jury instructions have been correct and not misleading or confusing to the jury. Second, again, as Mr. Smith argues, he avoids any reference to Mr. Blackwell. Mr. Blackwell was the innocent bystander. He testified that at age 17, he watched his friend being murdered and ran for his life. He offered very compelling testimony to every single charge that Mr. Smith was facing, including charges that Mr. DeShields' testimony did not cover, such as the robbery of Blackwell and the weapons charge related to that. So Mr. DeShields' testimony is wholly corroborated by Mr. Blackwell, and because of that, Smith now cannot show that the outcome of the trial would have been different. And finally, Your Honor, as detailed in the state's brief, the instruction that was given was an accurate statement of the law, and it touched on everything from what would have been a Boardley instruction other than simply pointing out again to the jury that DeShields was an alleged accomplice. Beyond that, it gave everything that Boardley would have required. It also didn't specifically discuss a deal with the state, but the parties had agreed that they wouldn't know what DeShields' outcome of his trial was or anything of that nature, although they knew he was incarcerated. And he didn't have a deal with the state. He just had an agreement that he would be housed at SCI for the duration of his sentence. Other than that, the instruction given gave everything that would have been in Boardley. And to answer Chief Justice's question about the reference in the trial court opinion, where it says that I think that's exactly what the trial court was getting to when he said the court gave the rest of the accomplice charge, meaning other than those first two lines, if you look at Boardley and compare them to the charge that was given, everything else is the general credibility. In Boardley it says, as stated elsewhere, meaning in the general credibility instruction, you can consider all of these things. I think this court found on direct appeal that defense counsel did a very good job of bringing out all the prejudices and Mr. DeShields' testimony, and the state maintains that the charge that was given was an accurate statement of the law and caused no prejudice to Mr. DeShields. Unless the court has any questions, the state will rely on its brief.
Thank you.
Just a couple brief points on the question of prejudice. I'm going to call the attention of the court to the factual statements beginning at page 14 in our opening brief, where it's outlined just every instance where testimony of DeShields was uncorroborated. The primary instance is DeShields' testimony about Smith was in on the plan to steal drugs from Coverdale and brought the guns. Blackwell doesn't know anything about that. That's all DeShields. So you have to believe DeShields to believe that Smith was an accomplice to a plan to rob Coverdale and bring guns.
And how do you respond to the state's argument that this was close enough to Boardley to pass muster?
Well, I think what the state is really saying is that Boardley somehow overruled Bland. And I would suggest that's not true. If you look at Boardley and you look at Cabrera, the rationale for affirming those convictions was, we're going to give the trial judge a lot of leeway in picking language. And we're not going to overrule the trial judge's choice of language. Now, I would suggest that Cabrera and Boardley and the approval of a watered-down Bland instruction was wrong, that the court was really, they didn't overrule Bland, but you're sliding down that slippery slope where at some point a trial judge or even this court is going to say, you know, we've watered down Bland so much now that Bland doesn't exist anymore. But if you read those decisions very closely, what you'll see is the court wasn't overruling Bland as much as the court was saying, we're going to give a lot of discretion here. We're going to even allow the trial judge to depart from the pattern instruction. So I think there's a problem there, and my suggestion to the court is that rather than continue to approve watered-down versions of Bland, the court should go back to Bland and recognize that it serves a real purpose and it ought to be a little more strictly enforced than it has been up to this point. This is a classic case where a pure Bland instruction was required and would have, in my opinion, certainly under the Strickland prejudice standard, the failure to give a Bland instruction certainly undermines confidence in the outcome. The defendant doesn't have to prove he would have been acquitted under Strickland. That is not the standard for prejudice.
Thank you, Mr. Bernstein. Thank you, counsel. We'll recess and take the case under advisement.